Beginning this morning's message, I'd like you to turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 9 and verse 3. Jeremiah chapter 9 and verse 3 reads in this manner. It says, "And they bend their tongue like their bow. Lies and not truth prevail in the land, for they proceed from evil to evil, and they do not know me, declares Yahweh." Jeremiah very clearly in this verse declared that lies prevail in the land. And as the saying goes, if the shoe fits, wear it. You know, it fits as much or even more in this day and age. What's being said here in Jeremiah chapter 9 by Jeremiah through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, it fits as much now, if not more, than the particular times or the specific times that Jeremiah was referring to in that verse. Lies indeed prevail in the land. In this time in history, that very thing is true. Lies prevail in the land. And let me prove it to you by just simply going through or reiterating or verbalizing some of the ways that explain or demonstrate the truth of that scripture, the truth of that statement from Jeremiah being here today. The false prophets, for example, are lying to us with their Judeo-Christian philosophies and doctrines. The politicians are lying to us with their campaign promises that they break as soon as they are elected and are in office. The media is lying to us by reporting only half the story in most cases and then distorting the rest of it to promote their hidden agendas. Our scientists are lying to us by teaching evolution resulting in humanism rather than special creation resulting in Christianity. Our educators are lying to us by distorting history. Our judicial system is lying to us by perverting justice. And even our parents have and are lying to us by remaining silent about what has been taken away from us, namely our freedom, while they slept. You know, lies indeed prevail in the land in this day and age. But this message, using that passage as a text for this message has to do with specific lies. There's no question that we're being lied to, maybe more than any other time in history. But this message has to do with specific lies that prevail in this land at this specific time. War lies. You know, I really believe that few. Matter of fact, I believe that there's probably no one who would challenge the fact that our government lies to us often. But during these last 4 months, the distortions being told by our government have become much more grave and very probably consequential. And yet, they are still being swallowed without question by the majority of the American populace. Why are they believing the lies? And specifically the war lies that are being told to us in this time, at this particular time. Why? Why are our people believing the lies? I'll say the easy answer. Simply because the media, in collaboration with our government, has told them, or is telling them, or has said that this is the way it is. And that is it. Here's a good example. Saddam Hussein has been made out by our government and by our media as being a Hitler-type madman. Matter of fact, at this point in time, he's being declared as the most dangerous man in the world. He's being made out as that, and the American public, at least the majority, are accepting that which is being said about this madman Hitler type, Saddam Hussein. Why? Again, simply because the media and the government has portrayed him as that. And that is the only reason that they believe that about Saddam Hussein. You know, if our media and our government had portrayed him instead, or were portraying him instead, as a great philanthropist, a great patriot and hero, you know as well as I do that the American public today would believe that's what he is. our American public believe the lies that are being told them simply because the media and our government has told them those lies. You know, let's face it, the average American citizen can't think on his own. You know, I hope in this message, I don't expect to reach the masses. I already know that that's impossible, that it's already been described as impossible in the Scriptures. But I hope in this message to at least help a few more be able to think, to evaluate what they're being told, and in this particular message in relation to the war lies that are being told them. What I want to do in this message is do an examination of the lies that are being told to us about this war. And that's right, I said this war. For we're already at war. We're at war. It's a war right now. And it is a war that is being fought right now with words, with blockades, barricades, and embargoes, and military deployment. We're already at war. The bullets haven't started to fly, but we're at a war, at least in that sense, already. And thus, we want to do an examination. An examination specifically of seven popular lies in the last 4 months that our people are being told about this crisis, this war in the Mideast. Lie number one. A lie that's probably the one that we hear, that we've been convinced of, most of our people have been convinced of from the very beginning, and that is that President Bush and our government, and when I say our government, I'm most specifically talking about our secret government, that secret government that Ollie North revealed that we have. The lie is that President Bush and our government would really rather not have a war. They're only doing it because they have to. Isn't that the way that it's being portrayed? That they're being forced, that the hand has been played, and they're being forced to have to go to war. Well, let's examine that first lie. You know, if that is true, then why wouldn't our government want to see Saddam Hussein killed? Especially if he's half the madman that he's made out to be. That's what Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said on public TV shortly after the August 2nd invasion of Kuwait by Saddam and his army. He was on public TV. I heard him personally. I forget what morning show it was on, one of the morning shows on one of the major networks, and he was there being interviewed, and he said there's one thing that we want to do, everything that we possibly can except kill Saddam Hussein. You know what's interesting about that statement that Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, Council of Foreign Relations member Dick Cheney, had to say is that it's very similar to a statement that was made just a few years ago by the then Secretary of State, George Shultz, on public TV concerning the then number one world public enemy, President Gaddafi. For he said the very same words, and I heard those as well. When he stood there on another one of those morning shows, as he was being interviewed and said, there's one thing that we want to do everything that we possibly can except kill Gaddafi. And it was right after they'd gone in and bombed his hometown and killed one of his children and killed who knows how many innocent lives. No, they're willing to kill his children. They're willing to kill innocent lives. But there's one thing they don't want to do. And that's kill Gaddafi or kill Saddam Hussein. Now think about that. Why wouldn't our government want these madmen, quote-unquote madmen, gotten out of the way? You know, when people hear that, I'm sure when the average citizen heard George Shultz or Dick Cheney say those things about Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, they must thought, what a benevolent person, what a benevolent government who wants to do anything they can except kill these madmen, in spite of them being the world's worst enemies. I'm sure that was how it was meant to be taken. We want to do anything. We'll kill their children. We'll kill other innocent lives. We'll destroy property. But we don't want to kill these madmen. Why? Why wouldn't our government? Oh, it's such a benevolent act. Sure. spare his life, spare their lives, so that thousands can be killed instead. You know, why doesn't our government, what's the real answer to why our government doesn't want these madmen, in this specific case, Saddam Hussein, killed? Plain and simple. Kill them, and our government has no possibility of a war. The madman must be there in order for there to be a war. You know, it's interesting that Gaddafi obviously figured that out. As much as hard as our government tried to force that man into a war, he wouldn't bite. He knew. I know that he must have known what was going on and what they had in mind. That they had another banker's war planned at his expense, and he didn't bite. But today, at least a few years later, they found another scapegoat, if you allow me to call him that. But this time they learned their lesson after trying to force Gaddafi into a war. This time they figured we better put him in a corner to where he can't get out. And it appears that that's where they've got the new madman on the block, Saddam Hussein. But you know, it did appear that just here 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, I'm not sure how long ago it was, that Saddam, I heard it on the news, the morning news, and I thought he found his way out. He found his way out of that dead-end canyon they put him in. Somehow he figured out a way to get out of the corner they put him in so he won't have to go to war. You know, if it's true that our government doesn't want a war, then let me ask you this question. Why wouldn't Bush let Saddam leave Kuwait with honor when Saddam had a quote-unquote dream? And I don't think you believe he had an actual dream any more than I do. But nonetheless, it was still his way out. Why wouldn't Bush, if he doesn't want a war, allow Saddam to leave Kuwait with honor when Saddam had his quote-unquote dream that Muhammad had visited him and told him to leave Kuwait and relinquish control of all the oil fields except for those that were on the very border of Iraq and Kuwait? If our government and our president doesn't want a war, why wouldn't they let this man get out with honor? If true that our government doesn't want a war, then why wouldn't Bush meet with Saddam when Saddam requested it just 2 weeks after that same incident? And if true that President Bush doesn't want us in a war, why won't Bush meet with him now when Saddam, as of 4 days ago, was still requesting dialogue? Think, people. There's more than meets the eye. Why? What's the answer to all this? Why wouldn't Bush do any of this? Because if you want a war, you don't meet with your adversary to negotiate terms of peace. You know, if I was a parent of a young person in the military sent to Saudi Arabia, I would encourage them to use Psalms 140 as their prayer, especially verses 1 through 3. And they read this way, "Rescue me, O Yahweh, from evil men. Preserve me from violent men who devise evil things in their heart. They continually stir up wars. They sharpen their tongues as a serpent. Poison of a viper is under their lips." And that prayer wouldn't be intended for Saddam Hussein. Lie number two is that this war is for any of the reasons that we've been told thus far. You know, the very fact that George Bush can't figure out or can't stick with one reason for our being over there is admission in itself that these reasons, that the reasons being given us are lies. Let's just look at George Bush's changing objectives in the last 4 months since the August 2nd invasion of Kuwait. We were first told, but only for a short period of time, that it was for the defense of Arabia. We were then told that it was for the defense of America, with statements from George Bush such as, quote, a threat that Saddam Hussein, quote, is a threat to the to U.S. security, end quote. Or that he, quote, threatens the American way of life, end quote. We were then also told that this was being done in defense of freedom, with statements from George Bush such as, quote, that it's to keep, it is, quote, to keep freedom's light alive, end quote. Sounds like awful beautiful rhetoric, does it not? Something that stir the masses to get behind the president. But then we went on to another reason for being over here, over there, and that was the threat of nuclear armament by Saddam and his country. But then it came down to, and all of these transpired in a short amount of time, but the biggest one that we've heard probably more than any of the others is to keep oil prices down. That we're over there to keep oil prices down. Well, let's look at some of these. Let's look at and examine some of these reasons that we're being told that, that our young men and our young women are being sent over to the sand dunes of Arabia. We were told in the very beginning, or near the very beginning of the tragedy that's going on over there, that it is for the defense of America and our freedom. Now ask yourselves this question: how is America? And just think, if our people would just do a little thinking, when we're told that we're over there for the defense of America and our freedom, how is America being defended by us sending our young men and women to the sand dunes of Arabia? How in the world are they defending America over there? Especially in light of the fact that we're becoming defenseless on the shores of America itself, opening up ourselves up to an attack that could conquer us without God's intervention. Oh, we're certainly protecting our country, aren't we, and our freedom. And think about this. If the news conglomerates had chosen not to report on Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, how many Americans would have known about it? A very small minority, I'm sure you would agree. And if they had not reported on it, how would those same Americans' lives who wouldn't have known about it changed by this madman, quote-unquote madman, invading this small country across the ocean thousands of miles away? Name me one way, somebody, name me one way that their lives would change if it hadn't been reported on and we hadn't gone over there, even though he would have done what he's done. Name me one way that American lives would have changed. You know, Saddam Hussein posed no threat to any American until we had threatened him. And that is a fact that cannot be denied. Now, I found it very interesting just this last week on Primetime Live. I don't know if any of you saw it, but Peter Jennings had an interview with Saddam Hussein that they broadcast, or at least parts of it, on tape on the show Primetime Live. The very last question that Peter Jennings gave them as they were leaving the room where he had interviewed them was concerning the hostages, the thousands of American hostages that are being kept there in Iraq by Saddam and his army. And this was Saddam's reply to him. Quote, "Those who come with no weapons don't leave empty-handed," end quote. In other words, he was saying, those who have not surrounded us with their army can come at any time and take their hostages home. And that's exactly what's happening. He is a threat to our hostages, not because he took them hostage, but because President Bush and our government took them hostage there in Kuwait. And there are even those in our government who would just as soon sacrifice those thousands of American hostages and other hostages from other countries for the sake of getting us into a war, have literally said that. I should have written down some of the congressmen and senators' names who are proclaiming, sacrifice them. We can't take that into consideration. We must attack. And, of course, you know whose side of the issue they're on or who's behind them or who they support. We'll talk about that at a later time. Somebody's going to come back and they're saying, but wait a minute, what about a nuclear threat? It's been estimated that within 3 to 5 years that Iraq will have the capability of having nuclear weapons. What about the nuclear threat? You know, I found it interesting this last week on the Phil Donahue show, one of the Phil Donahue shows I just happened to catch one morning as I was home. Even this ultra-liberal, and nobody will deny that, that Phil Donahue is an ultra-liberal, even this ultra-liberal Phil Donahue recognized that this was a lame excuse for a war. You know, he pointed out very clearly, we've got them. And not only that, but the Soviet Union has them. And think about this, the Soviet Union is a whole lot greater threat than Saddam Hussein with his little army over there in Iraq. And not only that, but India and Pakistan has them, and the Israelis have them. And do we go and declare war with them? No. So let's talk about real reasons for the war, is what Phil Donahue was really saying. He's saying that's one lame excuse. Why shouldn't he have them if everybody else is having them? Of course, oil prices is probably what we've heard the most about concerning this war, the reason for us being over there. But let's think about this one, too. You know, if the price, or let me ask, is the price of oil on the world market a justifiable reason to force a war with Iraq? Is that a justifiable reason to have a war? Well, think about this. Iraq imports much of its food from the United States. Would the raising of food prices justify Iraq blockading our ports if it had the power to do so, and coming into South America and threatening us with an army because we raised food prices? It's a perfectly viable comparison. You know, our government that seems so worried about higher oil prices and its threat to the quote-unquote American way of life, the same government had disregard for the quadrupling of oil prices in the 1970s by OPEC at a time when we here in America were much more dependent on oil from that region than we are right now. You know, if this is a legitimate reason, the raising of oil prices for us going over there and threatening him with war with our army, then why didn't we invade Saudi Arabia then at that time to lower the price of oil? And if there's so much concern for the consumer, why are our politicians right now wanting to add 50 cents a gallon gas tax onto the price of gasoline at the pump? Great concern by our government for us, isn't there? No, maybe we're just being lied to. You know, it's not likely, at least as some have said, that it's very unlikely that Saddam Hussein would have raised the price of oil to over $25 a barrel had we left him alone and just let him go his way. But isn't it interesting that George Bush, however, has, by his embargo, his blockade, and threats of war, already caused the price of oil to escalate over $40 a barrel. Yeah, they're concerned about the price of oil on the world market, aren't they? But here's the big question. And this question is asked in light of the fact, even if this was the real reason for our being over there. Here's the big question. Is lower oil prices worth tens of thousands of lives? You know, if you happen to think that it is, as I'm sure right now, because the media and our government has told the American public that it is a good reason. And if you're one of those who right now believe that it is, I challenge you to ask the first mother who receives her son or daughter back in a body bag if she wouldn't be willing to go to the gas pump and pay a few more dollars to have her baby back in her arms. What? It's nothing but a lame excuse, and one poor one, It just shows how stupid our people really are to accept such a unreasonable reason for our being over there threatening war. On top of it all, oil is available. First, we need to understand that only 3.5% of our oil comes from Kuwait, and only 5% from Kuwait and Iraq combined. The oil that we're using, only 5% comes from those two countries. And on top of that, on August 30th, 28 days after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, OPEC voted overwhelmingly to pump and supply more oil in order to make up for any shortages caused by the supply being cut off from Iraq and Kuwait. We've got the oil. First of all, there's no reason for us to be paying more at the pump right now. And that's not even talking about the oil we have in Alaska and other places in storage here in the United States. There is no reason for us to be paying more at the pump today. But what's more important, this is no reason. Even if it was happening, it is no reason for us to be over in Arabia, sending our boys and our girls, our young men and women, the cream of the crop from America, to be shed on the altars of war once again. Let me assure you that we are not there in order to keep oil prices down. And so, just in case people are starting to maybe wake up and that isn't a good enough reason or any of the other reasons aren't good enough reasons for us to be over there. In the last 2 weeks, Secretary of State James Baker announces the real reason we're over there, and that is to protect jobs. And he said, because that's something the American people will understand. So, let me ask you, which lame excuse will the American public believe? Probably all of them. And instead, they should be listening to the admonition found in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 14, where it says, as a result, we are no longer to be children, tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness in deceitful scheming. Lie number three that we want to examine is that Saddam Hussein is a madman Hitler type for invading Kuwait. You know, he's been labeled as bad as being, he's been labeled, or the worst that I think he's been labeled is that he's been labeled as the butcher of Baghdad. Let me state this for the record right off the top so that no one can think that I think that Saddam Hussein is a hero or a patriot or a man that we're necessarily to look up to as a great hero or anything like that. Let me state it for the fact. He's been called the butcher of Baghdad, and he probably is. He's a ruthless man. But let me ask you, whose man was he at the time these great atrocities were taking place? Whose man was he? For 10 years... during those times that they're talking about that he's and thus being called the butcher of Baghdad. For 10 years he received good press and billions in aid and arms and credit from the United States of America. Whose man was he when he was the butcher of Baghdad? America's! At least America's secret government. You know, the same man just months before the August 2nd invasion of Kuwait, who was our ally against the threat posed in the Gulf by the fanatical Shiites of Iran, the exact same man. And now, all of a sudden, our government is trying to coerce the Iranians to be our allies against him. But I think it's interesting, they're not going for it. Because in their minds, the greater villain is the United States of America. They see us worse than the butcher of Baghdad. You know, as Pat Buchanan brought out, I don't know how soon after this all took place. But as Pat Buchanan brought out in his one of his early articles, and I kind of understand that he's kind of switched sides now, that he's kind of backed off and is taking more of the liberal position on this thing. And some suspect it's because he has his eyes set on the next presidency. But for whatever reason, I don't know. But in the very beginning, at least, Pat Buchanan, I think, took the side of this issue that he should have, that he was one of those statesmen at that period in time that was voicing as it should have been voiced. And as he brought out so very well, he brought out what a great ploy to compare Iraq with Nazi Germany and Saddam Hussein with Hitler. What a tremendously great ploy, because who could ever question President Bush for not negotiating with another Hitler? Nobody's going to question that the way our people have been so brainwashed. So what a great ploy to call him all that they've called him, and especially the Hitler madman. You know, if Saddam is, then so is our past President Reagan for invading Grenada. It was no different. Because, see, the American people are not being told that Iraq has an historical claim to Kuwait. And, of course, we had a historical and rightful claim in Grenada. But so does Saddam and Iraq have to Kuwait. Kuwait used to be a part of the province of Basra, now Iraq's third largest city and major port, about 75 miles from the Persian Gulf. In other words, Iraq has a legitimate territorial claim to Kuwait. He had good reason, in other words, to go in there and do what he did. The same if we believe that President Reagan had for going into Grenada. You know, if Saddam is all that he's being called, then so is President Bush. And even more so for his invasion of Panama. You know, and he had the gall to call it Operation Just Cause, his invasion of Panama. You know, when the facts are known, President Bush was there only to keep Noriega from indicting him and his cronies in the drug trade. And in the process of that Operation Just Cause, there were over 2,000 innocent lives murdered during that invasion, as reported on 60 Minutes. Just not too long ago. If Saddam is, then so is President Bush. Lie number four is that Saddam Hussein transgressed some international law by his aggression and invasion of Kuwait. If this is so, then again, based on what I just shared with you, then Bush is guilty as well. Same thing. He went into Panama. If there's that international law that Saddam couldn't do what he did into Kuwait, then for the same reason Bush had no right by that law to do what he did in Panama, then he's guilty too. Note the double standards. Why didn't the U.S. get ready to go to war when Saddam Hussein did the exact same thing when Iraq invaded Iran? Why? Well, could it be that it was to the United States' benefit in that case? And of course, there was no concern when the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982, led by the butcher of Lebanon, Israeli Defense Minister Ariel Sharon. You know, I'll never forget the morning in 1982. I can't tell you the exact morning, but I'll never forget the morning. I think it was the day or second day after the day that Ariel Sharon, with his army, attacked the Lebanese, the women and children for the most part. Of Lebanon. I'll never forget, because at that point in time, President Begin was being interviewed. And it was just at that time when my eyes were beginning to open up, and I couldn't believe what he said there on public TV. Public radio. I didn't understand why he said it. I understand it now, because most of the American public are too blind, are too deaf to understand or see what he was really saying. But he said in defense of what Ariel Sharon had done to the Lebanese and the massacre of men, women, and children there. He said in defense of them, he said basically, I don't have it word for word, but he basically said, so what's the big deal about this? They're just goyim. And I thought, as I later understood more, the American public never knew what he said and accepted it. That must have been a good reason for Ariel Sharon to go in there and bomb Lebanon and wipe out hundreds and thousands of men, women, and children, innocent lives. And of course, across the American pulpits, most of our Judeo-Christian preachers were right there, amen, in every step that he took, and their great hypocrisy in their lies. You know why? Why didn't we have any great concern in that situation that was far worse than anything that Saddam Hussein has done yet? And of course, that's not even to mention the occupation of the West Bank of Jordan. Why didn't our government, for the same law, go over there and threaten them with a war? And of course, none of that's to be compared with the communist invasion of Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, etc., etc., etc. And we did nothing. You know, who are we trying to kid? Or better put, who is President Bush trying to lie to? Lie number five. And that is that the Soviet lie number five is that the Soviets are our allies in this action against Iraq. Lie number five again is that the Soviets are our allies in this action against Iraq. You know, let me just share with you some facts about that lie that we're supposed to believe, that the Soviets are with us and behind us in this action or any action. But let me specifically focus in on this, and let me say that we're being lied about the Soviets all along here. They have no more changed their plans for world dominion and communist oppression than anything. And this is just one lie that is included in the big lie that's being told us about the communists there in Russia. But let's just look at some of the things that are happening that proves that this is another one of their lies. That is that or at least a point to be made, and that is that Soviet citizens are allowed to leave Iraq while other foreign nationals are forced to remain in Iraq. Isn't that interesting? Soviets can leave, and yet they're on our side. They're behind. They're supposed to be supporting the American government and their invasion there in the sands of Arabia. And yet the Soviet citizens can leave at their free will. Another point to be made. The Soviets have admitted that they have military advisors stationed with the Iraqis. Matter of fact, they've admitted to 193 such advisors. Now, let's keep in mind, not only does our government lie, but there's no question that the communist government lies. So you know if they admitted to 193, that it's very likely there's a whole lot more over there. Matter of fact, it's been estimated that there's anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 advisors there with the Iraqi army. 193 they've admitted to, 193 advisors that are training Iraqi soldiers on the proper operation of sophisticated Soviet weaponry, including missiles. More than likely 2,000 to 5,000 over there at this time. It is also known that General Albert Mikhailovich Makhachev, the Soviet's best field commander, was sent to Iraq, listen to this, just 2 weeks prior to Iraq invading Kuwait. And it was known 2 weeks before Iraq invaded Kuwait. The same Soviet military leader, by the way, involved in the invasion of Afghanistan. And it is still known to this day that Soviet military equipment and other supplies continue to flow into Iraq. They are not the ally that we're being lied to that they are. Lie number six. That is that it is unpatriotic to be opposed to this war. Now, that's a lie that we haven't heard too much as of yet, but it's a lie I'll guarantee you that we will hear more of once the bullets start flying. That it is unpatriotic to be opposed to this war. there's no question that there's been already, before the bullets start to fly, a pre-planned roundup of all dissidents. Let me read to you some concerning that from the Spotlight, volume number 16, number 38, September 17th, 1990 issue. Let me read three or four paragraphs here. Under an article entitled "Want to Imprison Opposition," listen to this. Behind a curtain of wartime secrecy, the Bush administration is compiling a master list of citizens who will be held in, quote, preventive detention, end quote, or under, quote, supervision, end quote, the instant fighting erupts in the Persian Gulf. A little bit later it says, a joint task force of staff officials from six national security agencies and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. And if you haven't heard of FEMA in the past, pay attention, because you will definitely be hearing more of FEMA in the future. Again, it says a joint task force of staff officials from six national security agencies and the Federal Emergencies Management Agency, FEMA, has been meeting since August 14th, 2 days after the that's 12 days after the invasion. August 14th on an accelerated schedule to set up computer records on Americans suspected of being potential supporters or, quote, enablers, end quote, of, quote, Iraqi-sponsored terrorism, end quote. A little bit later it says, their plan has a legislative parallel on Capitol Hill in a repressive anti-crime bill introduced last February by Representative Newt Gingrich, Republican of Georgia. H.R. 4079, if enacted, would nullify the Bill of Rights, as the Spotlight reported in this issue of August 6th. Not only that, there's a very similar bill in the Senate. It's Senate Bill number 2245 that was introduced by Phil Graham. Later in this same article, it says, the worst part of this scheme, this is a quote from, who's this quoting? I believe it's Marco, a man named Marcos. Anyway, it says, quote, the worst part of this scheme, oh, here it is, said a Justice Department source, who, like most other observers, asked not to be quoted by name, is that a number of think tanks and so-called research institutes who are known agents of Israel or of its lobby are allowed to submit their confidential files on suspected terrorist supporters to the White House in preparation for this roundup, end quote. Among them are reportedly the Anti-Defamation League. I probably couldn't imagine whose names they might be submitting. Among them are reportedly the Anti-Defamation League, as well as the Center for International Security, operated by longtime Israel firster Joseph Cherba. And then it also says, if U.S. authorities decide to sweep up suspects on the basis of data concocted by the ADL or by sources such as Cherba, thousands of innocent patriotic Americans will suffer the devastation and ignominy of unreasonable, unconstitutional, preventive detention when we fight Iraq, end quote, warned Marcos. Yes, the time is going to come when the bullets start to fly, when it will be not only unpatriotic, but it'll be dangerous for anyone who has or is against the war that's already been started to be waged. And of course, we already know that one patriot by the name of Pastor Pete Peters has already been visited not once, but twice by U.S. Army helicopters. And I'm sure for speaking out on this issue. You know, I spoke with a man just this past week. A man who has a son who has just been shipped over to the area of Saudi Arabia. You know, in talking with him, I could tell he was really torn on whether to believe that his son was over there for a good cause or whether his son shouldn't be over there at all. I could just, in a short time of talking to him, tell him he was torn inside. He just really didn't know. Just in the things that he said, it was on one hand he wanted to be for it, he wanted to be behind it, but on the other hand he somehow, I think, knew in his heart that what was going on certainly wasn't right. Why? Why is probably he and so many other parents of children who have been sent over to that area of the world, why are they torn right now? Well, simply because our media, because of the media, and the lack of preachers and statesmen speaking out against it. You know, if our media was telling the truth. And if we had more preachers and more statesmen speaking out against this, this man wouldn't be torn at all. He'd know that it was an unjust cause and probably go to arms himself, or at least possibly go to arms himself to keep his son home or to bring his son back. You know, what a tragedy to think that it's unpatriotic to be against this ungodly war. You know, Teddy Roosevelt probably couldn't have said it better on patriotism when he said, quote, patriotism means to stand by the country. It doesn't mean to stand by the president or any other public official, save exactly to the degree in which he himself stands by the country. It is patriotic to support him insofar as he efficiently serves the country. It is unpatriotic not to oppose him to the extent that by inefficiency he fails in his duty to stand by the country. In either event, it is unpatriotic not to tell the truth, whether about the president or anyone else, save in the rare cases where this would make known to the enemy information of military value which would otherwise be unknown to him. End quote. You know, I'm sure up to this point in time, there would certainly be some who would think that I was awfully unpatriotic not to stand behind our government, not to stand behind the action that's being taken by our government, and not to stand, of all things, behind our president. But I hope to God they would listen to another president of an earlier time when they weren't quite so dishonest and who told it like it is and what it really means to be patriotic. It's patriotic to tell the truth about this war, about the war lies that are being told. Lie number seven, the seventh and last lie that's being told, and probably the gravest of all of them, is that we will win this war. You know, let me ask you, even if we win, even if we quote-unquote win this war, will the average American back home win or benefit from the victory? Hardly. Here's what he will reap, and this is probably a very limited list, but here's just some of what he will reap from a quote-unquote win or victory over there in the sands of Arabia. He will win a higher national debt. You know, before even going to war, right now, it is estimated that what is happening over there, before we send over another 100,000 to 200,000 soldiers, right now, with what we have over there and with what we're doing, it is estimated that it is costing the American public, the American government, $32 million per day. Right now. That's, by the way, I figured it up. That's $11,680,000,000 a year if it continues that long. You know what it's estimated? If we don't get into a nuclear war or chemical warfare, you know what it's estimated if what it will cost us when the bullets do start flying? At the very least, $40 billion a year. Oh, the American public, they're sure going to benefit from this war, aren't they? Yeah, we're going to benefit with higher national debt, and as a result, with higher taxes and greater inflation, and on top of it, higher gas prices, both now and in the future. Let me ask you, even if we quote-unquote win the victory, will the tens of thousands of young men and women who are slaughtered win? Now, how does the old saying go? Quote, war is good business, invest your son, end quote. And now your daughter too. 12%. It's estimated there's 12% of our forces over there are women. It's being called by our troops Mama's War. Our nickname, Mama's War. You know, instead, we ought to be listening to Proverbs 14 and verse 25 that says, quote, a truthful witness saves lives, but he who speaks lies is treacherous. And then let me ask you, even if we quote-unquote, win the victory, will the mourning parents of those slaughtered win a victory in this war? And fourthly, will the orphan children of parents murdered in this war win a great victory either? Oh, it's a great benefit to us, isn't it? And we're going to win. Yeah, somebody's going to win.
But people, it ain't going to be you and me. Just like it ain't been you and me since the Revolutionary War in this country. We've lost everyone, even though there's been declared victory. And we continue to pay the price with lives, with our money, with our substance. In conclusion, I feel it's necessary with this message to give a warning to those today who are spreading the war lies. I'd like you to turn with me to Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6 and verses 16 and 19. Listen to these words as a warning again to those who are spreading these war lies. Verse 16, there are six things which Yahweh hates. Yes, seven which are an abomination to Him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood. A heart that devises wicked plans. Feet that run rapidly to evil. A false witness who utters lies. And one who spreads strife among brothers. President Bush, you're guilty. You know, God very clearly, according to this passage, hates liars and those who shed innocent blood. But not only that, Psalm 63 and verse 11, his warning again, says, "The king will rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by Him will glory. For the mouths of those who speak lies will be stopped." And then Proverbs 19 and verses 5 and 9 says, "A false witness will not go unpunished. And he who tells lies will not escape. A false witness will not go unpunished. And he who tells lies will perish." And let that be a warning to those who are spreading war lies. In closing, rather than our normal prayer, our normal way of prayer, I'd like to read. And in prayer, you won't need to turn this, but just I want you to bow your heads, and I want to use this as our prayer. The prayer that's found, or at least part of what's found in Psalms, the 59th chapter, verses 9 through 13. Let this be our closing prayer against all liars. "Because of His strength, I will watch for thee, for God is my stronghold. My God in His loving kindness will meet me. God will let me look triumphantly upon my foes. Do not slay them, lest my people forget. Scatter them by thy great power and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. On account of the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them even be caught in their pride. And on account of curses and lies which they utter, destroy them in wrath. Destroy them that they may be no more. That men may know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth."